On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Connecting the Science to Managing LNAPL Sites. This is part two of a three-part series, and our focus today is on LNAPL conceptual models and the LNAPL decision process. My name is Mary Yelkin. I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. I'll cover some introductory materials, talk about how you can participate today, and then I'll turn it over to the ITRC LNAPL update team. Today's training is based on an ITRC guidance document that serves as the basis for this three-part series. And certainly we're able to provide quite a bit of information with the three parts, but there's much more information available in that ITRC guidance document. So if you haven't already, we strongly encourage you to access that document, and we hope that it will become a resource for you to improve your job performance as you're working on LNAPL sites. The training slides are available for you to download at the end of today's presentation. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. I do want to note that due to the government shutdown, we do not have technical support available from the CLUIN website that we typically do, but we'll do our best to resolve any technical issues within our session today. So if you are experiencing technical difficulties, go ahead and type in that Q&A pod and let us know what's going on, and we'll do our best to respond to those today. A few items of housekeeping before we get started. We are planned for 2.25 hours today. As I noted, this event is being recorded, so we can provide that as an archive to future ITRC learners. We do want to get your questions and your feedback today. You can ask your questions at any time in that Q&A pod in the bottom right of your screen. And then during the question answer breaks, we will try to answer as many of those verbally as we can. We'll also have our trainers answering some of those questions directly to you, and they'll type those back, and they'll come back to you in that Q&A pod. We do want to hear from everybody and get your feedback today. So we'll have a feedback form available for you to complete at the end of today's session. If you'd like a confirmation of your participation to support continuing education needs, make sure you fill that feedback form, click the box to certify you participated, and then a certificate will be generated for you. If you forget to click that box, just go back to that feedback form again and do click the box, and then that will be how your certificate will be provided to you. The ITRC has much more information on its website at itrcweb.org. But we are a state-led organization hosted by the Environmental Council of States, working in conjunction with ITRC's federal partners, being Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. We also have an industry affiliates program where consultants and others work alongside with academia, the community stakeholders, and our state and federal folks, and we work together to develop guidance documents, training classes such as you're participating on today to help people make better decisions when they're working on environmental sites. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, please review this ITRC usage policy, and we want to make sure that you credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty this material or endorse any specific products. ITRC is kicking off several teams in 2019, and they're working on guidance documents and training classes. If you're interested in learning more about how you can participate directly in ITRC, please go to the ITRC website. It's now my pleasure to introduce our trainers for today. All of them have been members of ITRC's LNAPL update team. First, we will be hearing from Tom Fox. He is with the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. And then Andrew Kirkman with BP America, Eric Nichols with Substrata, and John Smith with AECOM. So we very much appreciate them sharing their expertise with us today and throughout the many ITRC offerings of this LNAPL three-part series. So I'll now turn it over to Tom Fox with Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Tom?
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to part two of the training series. We are going to assume that everybody attended part one, and we're going to be very quickly moving into our part two content. Again, I want to remind you to visit the ITRC website to view and use the new web-based document. This guidance can be used for any LNAPL site, regardless of its size or the site use. Here's what's new about the LNAPL document and four easy bullets at the bottom. Basically, we've expanded the LNAPL key concepts section. We've developed and enhanced the LNAPL conceptual site model section. We've tried to give an emphasis in identifying SMART objectives, which we'll be talking about today. And we've also expanded the LNAPL transitivity and the natural source zone depletion, or NSZD, sections with appendices. Here are our learning objectives for the three-part series. In part one, we covered last week, and I'll go over this in a moment. In part two today, we're going to be developing a comprehensive LCSM for the purpose type of, of identifying specific LNAPL concerns. From that, we'll be establishing appropriate LNAPL remedial goals and specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound, or SMART, objectives for these concerns. We'll also be working to inform stakeholders of the capability and limitations of various LNAPL remedial technologies. In part three, next week, we'll be selecting remedial technologies to achieve objectives, preparing for the transition between LNAPL strategies or technologies as the site moves through investigation, cleanup, and hopefully closure, and we'll be smartly measuring progress toward an identified technology-specific endpoint. The main takeaway from part one of our three-part series is that knowledge and understanding about LNAPL behavior has evolved. We should all use that knowledge to improve our decision-making at release sites. Five key points from last week were that LNAPL does not sit like a pancake on the water table. Second, that LNAPL in a well does not mean that LNAPL is migrating or even recoverable. Third, that LNAPL transmissivity is a better indicator of recoverability than LNAPL thickness in a well. Fourth, LNAPL may be present in the subsurface even if it doesn't appear in monitoring wells, and it can cause long-term compositional concerns. And fifth, biological processes play a very large role in LNAPL depletion. These processes really haven't been appreciated until recently. And in summary, it's important to use LNAPL science and apply it to make good decisions at your sites. Our three-part training series focuses on helping you connect science to LNAPL site management, build your LNAPL conceptual site model, and select and implement LNAPL remedies. This training will be incomplete unless you also take this knowledge and apply it at your LNAPL sites. After this training, we expect that you will use it to improve your decision-making at your LNAPL sites. And for regulators like me, we hope that you can incorporate ITRC guidance into your own guidance. Today, in part two, we're going to be working on building our LCSM, our LNAPL conceptual site model, and we'll be asking the question, do you know where the LNAPL is and how to address LNAPL concerns? In relation to the process flow diagram in the LNAPL document, this is the section we'll be covering today. Today we'll be showing you how to develop a living LCSM and how that enables you to make better LNAPL remediation and management decisions. We'll be discussing key LNAPL and site data for the model, when and why those data may be important, and how to effectively organize the data into an LCSM. We'll also be discussing how to develop a site strategy by using the LCSM to identify and classify concerns, establish remedial goals to address concerns, and also develop remedial objectives. At the beginning of our presentation, we had a quick poll, and from what I could see watching it, it looks like answer B was the one that was running out front, and the three choices were the projects I work on are limited by either budget constraints, technical constraints, or time constraints. And I think for most people, they recognize that technical constraints are really the biggest limitation on getting a project investigated and closed. And this shows how important understanding the geology of your site and having a good LCSM is. At this point, I'd like to introduce Andrew Kirkman, and he's with BP America, and he'll begin with developing the initial LCSM. Andrew?
Sounds good. Gotta find my arrow. All right, great. So, oh, there's the arrow. All right, sorry about this. Things are a little slow here. I can't seem to drag the arrow. Don't know why.
Andrew, you might try clicking it off at the top and clicking it back on and see if that works.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be working. Got something. All right, we got it working here. Okay. So sorry about that technical difficulty. Okay. So yeah, as Tom said, we're going to talk about the LCSM. That poll, I think, is fairly informative and applicable because the LCSM can help with each one of those concerns. In terms of budget concerns, one of the ways that I believe the LCSM helps projects be cost-effective is focusing our characterization in the right spot and utilizing the most effective mechanisms. And we'll talk more about that today, as well as looking at technical consideration, better understanding the subsurface and geology, as Tom talked about, is going to help better understand our technical limitations. And the last point I have is with time. I found when projects are time limited, those are the projects where we have the least amount of ability to understand our LCSM. It's harder to confirm that we're selecting the right technology. And often we forego selecting a technology that has perhaps is more technically appropriate, but it takes a longer amount of time. For something that, you know, we're balancing out that time, we're prioritizing that time, and we may select something. So that's like a risk of that time factor, and I think that's one of the biggest risks I've run into on projects where we've had the biggest issues. And again, that affects our time and technical limitations. So with the LCSM, we have our initial LCSM here, and whether it's a new site or an old site, we're going out and perhaps we're revisiting the LCSM on an old site because we want to confirm, do those concerns that were initially identified still exist? Are they still applicable today? And maybe we're going to go back and review the data in-house, but we're going to be developing it to confirm that we have those concerns. Whereas a new site, we're going out to the field, we're collecting data, we're delineating the plume, and so that we can understand where the impacts relative to receptors, what are the impacts comprised of in terms of chemical constituents, and what is the magnitude of those impacts. We're going to verify concerns that are identified with threshold metrics, which are discussed in the document, establish our remedial goals, and then before we can select a remedy, we need to go and take a look at our conceptual model again and understand, do we have enough information to choose a remedy? An example is, while we may be able to delineate a dissolved phase plume relative to receptors and understand what our concerns are of that dissolved phase plume, that doesn't necessarily tell us, we don't necessarily quantify, say, the hydraulic conductivity to understand the permeability of the subsurface that those dissolved phase impacts are in to understand the potential remedial mechanisms that are best applicable. Groundwater extraction, air sparging, soil vapor extraction all rely on permeability of that soil, and has that accurately been understood, or have we simply delineated the extent of dissolved phase impacts with a monitoring well network? Following completion of our remedy selection LCSM, we're able to select a remedy and confirm that we have sufficient information for that remedy, and then we move into our design and performance LCSM. Perhaps we're collecting a few additional parameters to confirm the design of remedial well spacing or we're collecting, as we're operating that remedy, we're collecting additional information to not only know how the dissolve phase is evolving, but we're collecting, for example, we may be collecting oxygen content because we're biosparging the dissolve phase, and we want to make sure that that oxygen is getting utilized and biodegradation is progressing. And all that information goes to improve our LCSM and evolve it as that remedy is being implemented, such that at the end of operating that remedy, we have sufficient information to demonstrate, yes, the endpoints have been achieved, and we understand why those have been achieved. This is the same flow chart, but we do not have as many do loops. We've simplified it. So on the past previous flow chart, I should flip back. You know, there's certain points where perhaps at one point we do not have, I feel like we have enough information to select an LNAPL remedy, and or there is a challenge in terms of we're not certain that we can select a remedy to achieve the remedial goal, in which case we would go back, revisit, and confirm our concerns or identify new ones, establish alternate remedial goals or confirm those, and then go back and collect additional information to choose the right remedy. And so there's several do loops in here, but the main intent of this flowchart is that the evolution of the LCSM is not simply ongoing data collection. It is data is being collected at each step to make new decisions. Originally, we're doing the LCSM, the initial LCSM, to identify our concerns, the remedy selection LCSM, to identify what are the best remedies, the most appropriate remedies, and the design and performance LCSM to ensure that the technology is operating effectively and that we're collecting the right data to confirm that we've addressed our concerns from the initial stage. So the initial LCSM identifies specific LNAPL concerns. This document has broken those up into risk and safety, dissolve phase, vapor phase, LNAPL migration or LNAPL body stability and expansion, is the LNAPL body stable or is it continuing to migrate? Mobile LNAPL occurrence in wells. This is similar to maximum extent practical legislation that is applicable in many states and many programs, or are there other concerns such as aesthetics or sheens on water bodies. The new document has an appendix specifically targeting sheens. Overall, the concerns portion of the LCSM or the initial LCSM is typically well developed and mature. We're able to effectively at many sites identify what those concerns are, and that's not what I see at sites changing or people struggling with the most. There are recent improvements in this area, including ITRC's petroleum vapor intrusion guidance and online training, as well as in classroom, natural source zone depletion. And one of the big parts of natural source zone depletion is how it helps support LNAPL plume stability. It's been doing this all along, but our understanding of it previously was very limited, and thoroughly understanding that now helps explain why many of these sites have stabilized within the 6 months to 3 year period that has often been documented, and why these plumes, although you may have mobile LNAPL as well, they're not continuing to expand. LNAPL transmissivity as an improved metric of maximum extent practicable and recoverability, as well as that Sheen's appendix I recently discussed. Actually, we should have updated this slide, I apologize, but the TPH guidance is now published. And it is available as a good reference material on many aspects of TPH out there.
Hey, Andrew, can you speak a little more loudly, please?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the LNAPL 3 document has developed a completeness test for the LCSM, and this consists of a list of questions or you know, what really helping people understand what consists of the, what is needed for the initial LCSN. And rather than defining an amount of data, it's more so, have we answered specific questions? Do we understand, for example, the receptors? We need to understand where they are relative to the plume. We need to understand the extent of impacts and if receptors are affected. We need to understand my LNAPL migration, or if the LNAPL body is stable. LNAPL occurrence in wells is a regulatory-driven need. Hydraulic conductivity, as I talked about before, is not often needed to evaluate the concerns. However, it's often needed for remediation, some indicator of permeability and which technologies are going to be effective in moving fluids in the subsurface for remedial purposes. Distribution of LNAPL and dissolved vapor within the extent of the impacts, although we need to delineate those extents relative to the receptors, we're not often doing an in-depth evaluation of where those are vertically within the soil profile and for remedial purposes. And often those more detailed evaluations come later as we're selecting technologies to better focus on. So going through this sort of process resulted in the questions down here. These questions are typical of multiple guidance, ASTM, CRC CARE, IPCA, and US EPA. They encourage a systematic framework to develop an LCSM, as well as helping all stakeholders communicate about specifically what are the gaps in the LCSM that we see. And you'll notice that as you start at the top here, these really are questions that are not LNAPL specific. They're really for any environmental site, conceptual site model. However, as we go down the page and get more orange, they become more and more LNAPL specific. And the actual document, when you go to the actual document, and if you were to click on one of these questions, there are expansion boxes that talk more and more about these specific questions. So it's a nice way to reference it on the web. In terms of the amount of knowledge, we're looking at this. This is a figure that's been around for a while in multiple versions, but we really look at it in terms of how complex is your site in terms of hydrogeology and LNAPL composition factors, toxicity, versus above ground or site setting and physical factors. Is it an operating facility? Are there a lot of preferential pathways? As the number of preferential pathways or above ground complications increase, and as the subsurface geology increases, we go from a tier one that requires relatively limited amount of information to develop the conceptual model completely to a tier three, where more lines of evidence are required to answer those questions on the previous slides. So an example here is a tier one retail diesel and sand site where it's 10 to 15 feet to the water table. The dissolved phase plume is contained on site. Mobile LNAPL in wells has a transmissivity of 1 foot squared per day. LNAPL is not underneath any buildings, and the release occurred 10 plus years ago. Overall, we have a well-defined remedial concerns. There's no apparent risk on site. No receptors are identified within the extent of impacts or at risk of it, and the transmissivity is close to 0.8 feet squared per day. So we may need to do remediation, but overall we have a fairly complete conceptual model with that amount of information. There's a tier three retail down below where gasoline is an interbedded soil over bedrock. The water table is at 15 to 20 foot depth. It's just right at the bedrock layer here. The downgradient receptors have wells screened in 30-year-old bedrock, and those wells exhibit impacts. LNAPL is off-site and unconsolidated soil, and so what are the remaining questions? Those wells downgradient do have LNAPL impacts. However, We're not certain if they're getting there through the unconsolidated material, and the wells are old, so their well casings may not have good integrity, and it may be leaking into the well from poor completions, or is the dissolved phase actually getting through the bedrock. This is an example where additional lines of evidence and more investigation would be needed to better define the concerns for those receptors. So a knowledge check here. The concept of continually updating the LCSM throughout the remedial process means the LCSM should become increasingly complex throughout the remedial process. Even if performance monitoring indicates progress toward endpoints, better check between borings to ensure uniform treatment. C, reinvestigate with the latest tools as new characterization technologies evolve. D, the LCSM is updated to inform decisions throughout the project. Each decision point may require different data. And we have 100% on D, which is correct. And this is one of those questions that I often get as people talk about the consistent evolution of a conceptual model. You know, what does that really mean on projects? And I think, you know, that the D really will help people understand what the best answer and what the intent of that evolution is. So with that, let's see, we're going to go into a summary here. So for the initial LCSM, is there sufficient information for a given question to support identification of those concerns? Is additional site characterization required for evaluating the concerns LCSM? Initial characterization activities may go beyond collecting data for concerns. And so you may go out to a site and realize that I pretty much already know that I'm going to excavate or I'm going to have to do air sparging here, and I don't want to remobilize, so I'm going to be collecting some additional parameters all at the same time. And so combining mobilizations for concerns or remedial selection may improve efficiency at these sites. However, there might be sites that are more complex, and we need to go back and go through the data, do more data analysis prior to it, and those sites may require multiple mobilizations, one to help characterize the concerns LCSM, and coming back later once we started to better understand those to help focus what the remedy selection CSM is. With that, I'm going to be passing it on to Eric Nichols, and he's going to be helping us talk about the LMAPL concerns, remedial goals, and remediation objectives.
Thank you, Andrew. So Andrew's given us a good orientation to the LCSM, which itself evolves and changes as the site needs change. But we're going to take a look at the overall LNAPL decision process in these next few minutes and familiarize ourselves with some key concepts and terms. So the first objective we want to cover in the next few minutes is this one. We want to become familiar with the LNAPL decision process and some of these key terms, including LNAPL concerns, remedial goals, and remediation objectives. The next set of objectives that we're going to cover are understanding the three classes of LNAPL remediation objectives, and those include mass recovery, phase change, and mass control, and how we apply these, how we apply the ITRC framework to make LNAPL technology selections. And then the third objective for the next few minutes is to understand how various metrics get applied. And we'll talk about threshold metrics, which are sort of early ways to verify or eliminate LNAPL concerns. And we'll also talk about performance metrics, which tell you when you're done, essentially. So let's go ahead and orient ourselves in the process. This slide shows a very simple roadmap from identifying your initial LCSM, which helps you identify concerns, through identifying concerns and establishing LNAPL remedial goals, and then going on to identify objectives and implement and monitor those remedies. The piece we're going to talk about for the next few minutes is this red piece here, identifying the concerns and establishing the remedial goals. So what needs to be done at your site? Andrew introduced this concept a few minutes ago that the LCSM, the initial LCSM, is geared at identifying specific LNAPL concerns. And in our regulatory document, we look at four categories of concerns, which we'll talk about more in a minute. But I want to mention also here that concerns often involve stakeholder engagement, and many of your concerns may come from various stakeholders involved in the process. And there's a chapter in our guidance document specifically on stakeholder engagement. I believe it's chapter 2. So please take a look at that for more information on stakeholder engagement. Let's take a look at these concerns one by one in a little more detail. So of the LNAPL concerns, the first category is risk and safety. And this could include concerns about PVI or petroleum vapor intrusion. It can involve concerns about ingesting groundwater that's affected with petroleum constituents. It could also involve things like fire and explosion or other acute safety hazards. The next category of concern are concerns about the migration of the LNAPL itself. So in other words, if the LNAPL body itself is continuing to spread, that may result in future risks at some other location. And then the third category of LNAPL concerns is this one Andrew also introduced that really addresses the MEP, or maximum extent practical requirement, which is still in many regulatory agency frameworks. This is basically to abate the occurrence of LNAPL in wells down to some regulatory level and the concerns related to that compliance requirement. And then finally, there's a grab bag of other types of concerns, and they can be vast. A few are mentioned here. Sheens, which we have an appendix for, geotechnical concerns related to LNAPL saturated soils, and things like stains and odors as well. So those four categories are potentially going to lead to different remedial strategies. And to summarize that, this slide shows that process in a generic way here on the left, where we identify concerns and then establish goals and objectives and select a remedy and implement that remedy. Well, how does that play out for specific kinds of concerns? Well, for an example here, the first category of concerns, risk and safety, those concerns are shown here. We just mentioned those in the slide or two ago. And then the key take-home message here, one of them is, there may be an off-ramp where you have some data already in hand to address those concerns and decide whether they require a remedy at all. And we'll go into that in a little bit more detail in a slide or two. And then also, those concerns may lead to specific LNAPL remedial goals and specific groundwater or remediation objectives, and then the selection of a remedy to achieve those goals using those objectives, and then to close out the site when you're done. The key point here at this stage is I just want you to appreciate that specific kinds of concerns are going to result in specific kinds of goals and objectives and specific remedies. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. Migration concerns are shown here. Same thing. The take-home message here is simply that different types of concerns may result in different kinds of goals and remedies. And then here's for the MEP. A preview about a concept we're going to talk about in a few minutes. Notice that both mobile LNAPL occurrence concerns and migration concerns really involve conditions of excess LNAPL saturation. So both of these types of concerns are going to have saturation-based remedial goals. More on that later. So backing up to the threshold step, if we have, let's say, a risk and safety concern, we may have information in hand to be able to tell us whether that concern is already addressed or whether it needs to be carried through to some kind of remedy. And an example of that might be, let's say we are concerned about ingesting groundwater that contains toxic components from LNAPL, dissolved LNAPL. We may have enough, a body of information on groundwater monitoring and locations of potable use wells and potentially some information on plume stability to know whether or not that concern has already been addressed. So this may be, there may be an off-ramp here, and the key point here is that not every concern is going to necessarily result in a remedy. Some may get off-ramped earlier in the process. But for those that don't, in other words, ones that are verified, those verified concerns are going to need remedial goals and eventually some kind of management and remedy strategy. So let's go ahead and open up a poll and do a little attention check here. So which of the following statements is true, and only one of them is, an LMAFL concern is A, does not need to be identified before remedial action concern occurs, B, may sometimes be addressed by testing against a threshold metric, C, is nothing to worry about, or D, can only be addressed through remedial action. And the early polling is quite overwhelmingly D, which is exactly the right answer here. We want to test concerns when we can, when we have the information to do it, with threshold metrics. We won't always be able to do this, but if we have it, it's a good opportunity to off-ramp some concerns. So let's go ahead and close that out. And I'll move on here. So I gave you a little preview a minute ago about how concerns may result in different types of remedial goals or translate into different types of remedial goals. And here is an example. If we've got a risk concern, we're really concerned about specific risk-driving components, such as benzene from gasoline or maybe naphthalene from a middle distillate. Those things have to do with the composition of the LNAPL. So our LNAPL goal, the thing we want to change about the LNAPL, is probably going to be its composition if we're driven by a risk concern. If we have a migration concern where the LNAPL body itself may be migrating, that's really driven by a condition of excess saturation. So our LNAPL goal is going to be centered around reducing that saturation to reduce that migration potential. Similarly, for an occurrence concern where we have LNAPL accumulating in wells, that's also a mobility or migration issue in some to some degree. At least it's saturated enough to migrate into a well. That's going to drive a saturation-based goal, reducing that saturation to reduce that occurrence. And then the other can be a number of things that might involve changing a strategy that reduces odors or stains or some combination of composition and saturation. So this next slide is an important slide that distinguishes between two words that really sound the same, goal and objective. And what's the difference here? A goal is really kind of the aspirational future state where it's what we want to the desired change we want in the world, in our LNAPL world. It's the change in LNAPL conditions that we want to achieve. It's essentially what does winning the war against the LNAPL look like when we're done? And we need to think about that before we choose a remedy, because remedies act in different ways. So we need to know what we're trying to achieve first. Now, objectives are more like the tactics that you use to achieve that ultimate goal. These are the actions and the desired outcomes that need to occur using a particular technology. And they often kind of are done in parallel with remedy selection, because sometimes you're going to express these objectives in terms that relate to your particular remedial technology. It's worth noting here, if you're familiar with the previous ITRC LNAPL guide, the one that came out several years back, we've actually flipped these definitions to be more in line with common English usage and usage in the business world, for example. So if you're confused by these terms from the old guidance, take a moment to relearn them here in the new guidance, because they are different. So among of the LNAPL remedial goals, we need to express that desired condition that we want to achieve with the LNAPL. And that's going to change depending on whether we have a composition-based goal or a saturation-based goal. So, for example, if we have a composition-based goal, we may be aspiring to reduce vapor concentrations, for example, or reducing groundwater concentrations of specific risk-driving constituents. Similarly with saturation goals, we may be looking to reduce that saturation or to contain that saturated L-NAPL to keep it from migrating. So we need to clarify these remedial goals before we can choose a technology, because different technologies are going to act differently to either change composition or change saturation. So for L-NAPL remediation objectives, again, these are kind of like the tactics. So this is how that goal will be accomplished using a particular technology. So it's at this stage to start thinking about technology selection and how you're going to express these tactics in terms of your technology. These objectives are supposed to state the actions and desired outcomes that you need to achieve with the chosen technology. And as Tom mentioned, in order for these really to be rational and achievable, they need to be SMART, where we mean specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time-based. If you're missing one of these elements, you may not know when you're done, or you may not have a well-formed strategy. So among the L-NAPL remediation objectives, we've broken them into three main categories: mass recovery, phase change, and mass control. These are the actions, the mechanisms by which a particular technology acts to change the L-NAPL conditions. So mass recovery, we may want to express those objectives with terms like abate the L-NAPL by removal of L-NAPL mass, or remove mobile L-NAPL to a particular defined point, et cetera, et cetera. And the key point here is that each of these objective statements typically includes an active word such as stop or abate or control, so that we know what we're trying to achieve with that particular technology. Another point here is that natural source zone depletion, which you've heard about a little bit in Module 1, you're going to hear more about later, is one of the technologies that can work across all three categories of these objectives or of these mechanisms. Sorry, here I had to back click one. So this slide shows a first cut of how to think about technologies. What do they do, and what mechanisms do they employ? In our guidance document, we call these the primary mechanisms by which the L-NAPL remediation takes place. And some technologies have more than one effect, and therefore they may serve more than one objective more than one concern. And we can express this kind of like a ternary diagram here by this triangle. And an example here, the black dot here represents what, for example, dual phase extraction might do, where it's both volatilizing and extracting and biodegrading L-NAPL mass. So it has elements of both mass recovery and phase change in its effect. So we can have mixed effects for specific technologies. And then once we've chosen that technology, and we'll talk way more about that later this module and even in more detail in the next week's Module 3, we need to think about what done looks like and what good implementation looks like. And for the implementation part, we need to establish performance metrics. And these tell us whether the remedy is operating as it should, and making sure that we're getting that remedy to all the places where it needs to get, for example, and maintaining the conditions that allow that remedy to perform. And then ultimately, we need to know when that remedy's done. So what do the endpoints look like? These are what define remedial action completion. So rather than just being done when we're tired or running out of money, we'd really like to think about what done should look like and establish some measurable metrics for that. And all of these, again, are SMART. So that takes us right up to our first question and answer break. So I'm going to turn this back over to Mary.
Thank you, Eric. We do now have time for questions and answers. For those of you that would like to type your question in, you can do that in that Q&A box, and we'll try to respond to as many of those as possible verbally. Also, if we don't get to your question, we'll try to have the trainers respond directly back to you within that Q&A pod. For those of you on the phone line, you can ask your questions out loud if you would like. And in just a moment, I'll give you an opportunity to do that. And it is #6 to unmute. We do have the part 3 of this training class coming up on January 29th. So since you're registered for this and you've already participated in part 1, you're automatically registered for part 3. So make sure you join us next week. As we're waiting for some questions to come in here, I will also remind people that we have classes open for the remainder of January and February as far as registration. And on January 31st, we have characterization and remediation in fractured rock. In February, we have a couple courses coming up on risk assessment. Also on February 21st, as Andrew mentioned, ITRC does have that new TPH document that has just come out. We have our first online training of TPH risk evaluation at petroleum contaminated sites, and that will be coming up again February 21st. Registration is open for that. I do want to open it up to our phone lines. If you have any questions and you'd like to ask your question out loud, don't forget to hit #6, and we'll give you an opportunity to ask those now. All right, we did have a question come in. It says, how do I access part 1 recording as I was not able to attend? And to access the archive recordings, you can go to the ITRC website, and in the internet-based training section, there is a link there that will take you to our archives page, and then you scroll down to look for the course title that you're interested in, and that will provide access to part 1. We have a question that says, is it possible that monitoring well with little napple thickness would result in confusing bail down test results?
Can you say that again for me? Sorry.
Yes. It says, is it possible that monitoring well with little napple thickness would result in confusing bail down test results?
Yes.
Yeah. So ASTM recommends that you should have 0.5 feet of thickness for a bail down test, and about 0.1 foot of thickness for a manual skimming test, and either of those give oil transmissivity values. So the lower the thickness, you should consult the ASTM guidance document to work through how to conduct the test. If you're looking to see if recovery is going to be effective and you're concerned that is a thickness in a well that is 0.05 feet of thickness, then go to your boring logs, your soil analytical data, and develop an understanding of what is the thickness of your smear zone where you have residual oil across the soil profile, and how large is that relative to the monitoring well LNAPL thickness that is being observed. If it's significantly larger, several feet of smear zone, 2 or 3 feet of smear zone, and you're looking at 0.05 feet of thickness, then your LNAPL body is dominated by residual oil. Analytical data can help better quantify this if you have several samples across that smear zone and one near the mobile interval. But that's really the intent, is LNAPL recovery going to reduce that LNAPL source body in a meaningful way? Additionally, is LNAPL recovery going to stabilize that LNAPL source body? And the ITRC LNAPL document provides, here are the lines of evidence to document the stability of a source body. Has the overall footprint of impacts remained the same for LNAPL over time? have, is the site still active? Are there still potential for new releases or ongoing releases, or have those been removed? If those have been removed, it's less likely because the majority of plumes stabilize within a few months to 3 years. Is your dissolve phase plume stable? If a stable dissolve phase plume is indicative of a stable LNAPL body, a stable or shrinking dissolve phase plume even. And overall, low transmissivity or thicknesses that are intermittent are indicative where residual oil dominates the LNAPL source body, and it has overall low mobility and low driving head. So consult the online web document, and that may help you work through that thought process more.
Thanks, Andrew. Any of the other trainers want to add in on that? All right, let's go back to our phone lines. Any questions from our phone lines? And it's #6 to unmute. All right, that seems to be all the questions we have at this point. We will go ahead and move on to our next portion of the presentation. Just a reminder for those of you who do need continuing education confirmation, you can get that certificate of participation by completing the feedback form at the end of today's training class, and make sure you click on the box that certifies you attended today, and then a certificate of participation will be generated for you. We have had another question come in. It says, I have a site where BTEX along with many other industrial chemicals were dumped for years back in the 1970s. Why do I still see BTEX today?
So when you look at the depletion mechanism, you're transferring, you have LNAPL mass in milligrams per kilogram of soil, and that's not really directly relatable to a milligram per liter. A milligram per liter of, say, BTEX in dissolve phase is fairly small relative to 1,000 milligrams per kilogram in soil. And your depletion process, your solubility, for example, is relatively low. Volatilization, you could say, is a more rapid process, but again, it's going to be relatively small, perhaps to the magnitude of LNAPL in soil out there. And so, you know, if you're looking in the center of the plume, you would expect to see changes much more slowly or no changes at all over time. Whereas if you look on the fringes, you might be able to see changes occur sooner relative to that. But there are depletion processes occurring most likely at the site, and that have stabilized that LNAPL body. And also the driving head is likely low since the releases occurred a long time ago, so the body is stable. The processes are depleting, but they're all fairly small relative to the amount of mass remaining there.
All right, thank you, Andrew. Let's now continue on with our presentation today on slide number 39, and I'll turn it back over to Andrew Kirkman with BP. Andrew?
So the remedy LCSM, this is relatively new compared to the 2009 document, this topic. And why are we focused on it? You know, current practices and resulting CSMs are effective at identifying the risks and concerns at given sites. We're also able to sufficiently identify when we've completed remediation or there are no more concerns and risks. However, identifying technologies to achieve those project goals is really what that first document was working to improve, and that's really what we're continuing here. This is where a remedy selection LCSM can help us improve, and there's been several improvements since 2009 in understanding where to target remedial technologies, which ones are going to be most effective. A lot of that is based on improved understanding of the CSM. And historically, remedies have been selected based on incomplete understanding of LMAP occurrence in nature. We'll talk about some of those examples here. Remediation has often been driven by, for example, LMAP thickness without considering the relationship between thickness and recoverability, i.e., in addition to thickness, there are other factors that affect recoverability, such as the soil permeability, the LMAP type, and the saturation and how that affects LMAP recoverability. And this is where LMAP transmissivity has come in. It actually integrates thickness with these other parameters to give an overall better improved, a more improved metric for recoverability. So the remedy selection LCSMs aims to inspire continuation of improvements to CSMs for this remedy selection purpose. So for the remedy selection, you know, if we know our concerns and we know the remedial technology types, should we go ahead and give it a shot? The point is just because we have LMAP thickness in a well doesn't mean that we necessarily understand the best technology to go address it. Or LMAP in a well where there's no migration, vacuum trucking it out, we have not yet quantified or understood what the actual benefit that will be to the source. Insufficient data or insufficient analysis even often exists at the end of the concerns LCSM to choose the remedy that will achieve the project goal. A closer look at a vacuum truck scenario. If we have our above ground data here, a thickness in a well of 2 feet, transmissivity of 2 feet squared per day, the volume that is known to equilibrate within the well casing and the filter pack itself as that well equilibrates after a given removal event to 2 feet of thickness, we're going to have about 1.4 gallons of LMAP that's within the casing and the filter pack. If we come out monthly with a vacuum truck and induce 2 feet of drawdown over an hour, we're going to remove this 1.4 gallons of LMAP plus about 1.7 more gallons is going to flow into the well due to the induced drawdown, or 3.1 gallons a month, or 36.2 gallons a year. This 1.7 that flowed into the well, I calculated that based on the transmissivity value that is representative of the well conditions and the drawdown induced and the time frame that we induced it over. So we got 36 gallons per year. If we now come down here, we have the same 2-foot mobile LMAP interval of oil in the formation that's sitting in that well. It's a relatively sandy material. The saturation, though, across that 2 foot, so 8% to 45% of the porosity is occupied by LMAP, right? The rest is water and air. It's a multi-phase system, a lot like that shark fin that's in the first training. And 8% is our residual, and so on average, we have about 27% mobile saturation, and we have a 5-foot smear zone. So if we take a radius of 25 foot and this average mobile saturation of 27, it will take us 25 years to reduce the LMAP volume sufficiently to reach 0.8 feet squared per day. And on average, we're going to reduce the saturation across that 25 by 0.4%. So 4 out of every 1,000 pores is going to have LMAP removed from it each year from vacuum truck recovery. However, we can also use the API LMAP distribution and recovery model with published values for soil and LMAP parameters, but we're going to get it to calibrate to this 2 foot of thickness and 2 feet squared per day. And we're going to run an active skimmer scenario in there. And it tells us that active skimming reaches the same 0.8 feet squared per day in less than a year. Why is that? Well, this vacuum truck is coming out for 1 hour out of every 30 days. It might be inducing 2 feet of drawdown, and perhaps the skimmer is inducing 0.2 feet less of drawdown. But we're operating it 100 times more frequently. We're operating it continuously, whereas, you know, this is the 1/24th of a day and 1/30th of a month, and this is continuous. And so this is an example of a screening calculation on how LNAPL transitivity can improve remedy selection. And these types of tools is what's really been evolving over the last several years. And they're not just for LNAPL recovery. The idea is, this is what we've learned about LNAPL recovery. What have we learned about other remedial mechanisms, or what has existed that we can simply apply to improving our remedy selection for other remediation mechanisms such as biodegradation or volatilization? So remedy selection should not be informed by the LCSM, by the concern. It should be informed by the LCSM itself. And the concern associated with a gauged LNAPL thickness or dissolved phase concentration does not necessarily indicate how to eliminate it. So we're going to go into more in depth on where remediation needs to target, how to understand that at sites, what are the characterization tools we can use, or what's the data we can use, and how do we apply that, which remedial mechanisms may be effective based on given conditions, and look at improved quantification of these mechanisms prior to implementing a technology. And I look at this as a screening level approach. It's not meant to give the answer within 10%. It's meant to give an answer within a factor of 2 or 10 in terms of how these things are improving. It's the screening level. So similar to the concerns LCSM, where we developed a list of questions, we also developed a list of questions for the remedy selection CSM that include, where is the source mass? Is it in homogeneous, permeable, sandy soil? Is it interbedded within coarser zones that are surrounded by finer grained layers? Is it within low permeability media or secondary porosity, fractures, karst? Or is the LNAPL source distributed above or below the water table? This is going to affect what remedial technologies we select. And as the last one, the colors were significant. The colors here are more so are just representing that these are all roughly in the same category. But as we go from question 1 to 2 to 3, these actually rely on the previous questions. And so when you go and take a look at this section, there's also drop-down boxes here that explain more of these in the webinar, the web-based document, to help you work through these. But what is the nature of the source? Is the LNAPL volatile or soluble? Volatility applies to soil vapor extraction, for example. Is it biodegradable? What is the mobile versus residual fraction? Somebody had asked about thicknesses, confusing bail-down tests, small thicknesses, and I talked about, well, really, when you're doing a bail-down test, you're generally thinking about recoverability. Another way of looking at recoverability is, what's my mobile interval as compared to my residual zone, and how much is that going to reduce the overall source in terms of longevity of my LNAPL body? What is achievable for a given technology? We're going to talk about mobility-based limits today, volatilization-based limits, solubility, biodegradability, but there's other factors in here. In terms of, some sites may have above-ground structures or maybe an operating facility where more aggressive technologies like steam or access may limit sparging, for example. And those are affect what is achievable for individual technologies. So where is the source map? This question is looking at identifying where to target remediation. A lot of high resolution characterization discussions and improvements are focused on this, including the use of laser-induced fluorescence and membrane interface probe. This identifies the physical factors and limitations to consider for impacted soil, such as soil permeability and depth, the absolute depth, for example, excavation, or the depth relative to the water table. Am I treating a vadose zone or a saturated zone, or am I treating both of them? And so you can take a look at tables 4.2 in the document for additional characterization tools. This table provides a summary for whether you're trying to go after a given component, such as the geology, the hydrogeology, or the LMAPL. It then identifies specific tools that can help characterize those, of what standard methods are used with them, and a brief description. So we're going to do a brief discussion of tools for where is the source mass next here. We have a cross-section here where we have well screens. And in the given well screen, blue column represents gauged water. Green represents gauged LMAPL thickness, or you may have green overlying blue in case where we have gauged LMAPL over gauged water. The red represents laser-induced fluorescence borings, and this is a fill material overlying a fine-grain clay and silty material, which overlies a fine sand. The LIF data here indicate that the bulk of the response was in the sandier formation. In the center of the site, we do have intermittent hits in the clay. If the release is at the surface, the LMAPL had to migrate down vertically some way. But on the periphery, the bulk of the response is here in this sandy material. And we're going to zoom in on that location there where we had 2.4 feet of LIF response in the sandy material, but we gauged the thickness of 7.1 feet. This represents confined LMAPL. Confined LMAPL can occur wherever LMAPL initially had a sufficient head from a release to push through the water table. LMAPL often distributes itself more like an iceberg. A certain fraction of it is above the water table, but another portion exists below the water table, and LMAPL distributes itself across the potentiometric surface. During release, LMAPL can penetrate the water to a relatively large depth, and then as it spreads out, the mobile interval thins back out here. And so wherever there is a finer grain soil overlying a coarser soil, and the initial release head has enough head to push the oil into that coarser soil, there's potential for confined LMAPL to exist at sites. And this is an example where understanding this helps understand which technologies for recovery will be effective. We do not want to use a vacuum enhanced skimming, soil vapor extraction, or a multi-phase extraction at this site because the vacuum would be applied to the fine-grained clay interval and have limited effect on the submerged sandy zone that contains the bulk of the LMAPL. LMAPL skimming or water-enhanced drawdown would be the most prudent technologies to use at this site based on the confined LMAPL conditions. There are other tools besides LIF to help identify confined conditions. Diagnostic gauge plots were briefly discussed in LMAPL 1, and this is an example of a diagnostic gauge plot for that same well we were just looking at. Here we have our fluid interface elevation on the y-axis. The green dots here represent gauged air LMAPL interfaces. The blue dots represent gauged LMAPL water interface elevations. And with any well, as you go out and you purge it, for some period after that, the well is not going to be in equilibrium. The fluid levels are not going to be at static equilibrium. And that represents these data points circled in red here. These are data points that were collected a few days after a well was purged, and the well was in fact still recovering. Wells don't necessarily recover overnight for LMAPL. Sometimes the mobility is sufficiently low where it takes them weeks, or I've seen wells that require months to a year to recover. The data points here along the black line represent the air-oil interface elevations that were gauged for equilibrium fluid level data. The thickness is down here, and as we got to larger thicknesses, the air-oil interface elevation rose. This is similar to what happens for water in confined wells. The top of the water rises as the pressure of the aquifer increases, but overall the thickness in the aquifer stays the same. It's simply an expression of pressure. The oil-water interface remained relatively at the same elevation across various LMAPL thicknesses. When you see this sort of pattern with gauging data, it's indicative of a confined LMAPL scenario. Now we're going to overlay the soil contact elevation onto this plot. So here's the fine-grained layer up at upper elevations here, and here's the LMAPL water interface. My y-axis kind of got messed up here. So here's about 962 feet roughly, and you can see here that the difference in elevation is around 2.5 feet, similar to that 2.4 feet of LIF response that was gauged. So tools like this, your standard boring logs, your gauging data, they can help identify where those intervals of mobile LMAPL are to improve remedial technology selection. This is another cross-section at a different site. Here our LMAPL thicknesses gauged is in black. Our LIF response, again, is in red. And we have a gray silt with some sand and clay in it that is overlain by a sandy, silty sand material with fill again at the top. The LIF responses are slightly above the water table. They're near it. And here we have the LIF response here just above the water table, but our gauge thickness extends down below the water table where there's no LIF response. When we zoom into that location and take a look at a diagnostic gauge plot, and we also took soil cores there and photographed them under visible light and ultraviolet light, where LMAPL fluoresces under ultraviolet light, we see that the LMAPL are in coarser, sandier zones, whereas the finer grained, siltier zones are not fluorescing and do not contain the LMAPL. It's easy to see how if LMAPL is in this sandy zone currently and your water table drops, the LMAPL may not migrate vertically through this silt material. Instead, it flows into the well and as a perched interval. This is the entire interval of fluorescence observed, even though gauge thickness was on the order of 4 feet at its highest. This is the entire interval of LMAPL impacts observed in core photography. And in this case, as our gauged LMAPL thickness increased, our groundwater elevation essentially, our potentiometric surface was dropping. In the last one, the air oil interface is proportional to potentiometric surface, and it was rising for higher gauged LMAPL thicknesses. Here, as the potentiometric surface is dropping, our gauged LMAPL thickness increases. And for this example here, our gauged LMAPL our potentiometric surface dropped less than a foot, or about a foot, but our thickness increased by 4 feet. This large increase in thickness, as compared to the drop in the potentiometric surface, is representative of perch conditions. For unconfined conditions, where you have LMAPL in a medium sand and the water table drops, you'll often see your thickness also increase. But for a foot of water table drop, in unconfined conditions, your thickness will increase by a foot or less for that condition. So that's kind of a rule of thumb. If it's your thickness is increasing by a foot or less for a given drop in the water table, it's unconfined. If it's by more than the factor that the water table has dropped, it's likely perched. And you can apply these diagnostic gauge plots to bedrock as well. So the ITRC has a bedrock characterization document out, as well as the new LMAPL 3 document on the web also discusses LMAPL and bedrock. But here's a diagnostic gauge plot where we have a consistent LMAPL water interface. Here's our potentiometric surface that's rising and our air oil interface that's rising as gauge thickness goes up. This is indicative of confined LMAPL, and a conductivity profile log was run here that identified a fracture at a depth corresponding to where the oil-water interface is. This is likely the fracture in this location that is impacted with LMAPL, whereas the deflections up here are not likely the ones that remediation would want to focus on. This is the elevation I would be focusing remediation towards at this location. So in summary, characterization data to support where is the source. You have your soil boring logs. You can be using high-resolution tools like the cone penetrometer tool, CPT, or hydraulic profiling tool, soil core photographs, fluid elevation versus soil data, diagnostic gauge plots, cross-sections, hydrographs with geology plotted on there or even hand-drawn elevation lines, and LNAPL bail-down tests. AFTM and API both have guidance documents on bail-down tests and LNAPL transmissivity to help work through how to use these to understand confined and perched conditions. For LNAPL source distribution, you know, PIDs or headspace analysis are useful for gasoline range. And while, you know, heavier fuels such as diesel may not volatilize as well as gasoline, but shake tests, soil shake tests, putting soil in a jar with some water, shaking it up, and confirming that a sheen or a layer of LNAPL thickness appears helps identify LNAPL impacts versus soil that is dark due to oxidation reduction conditions or, you know, naturally dark soil. TPH analysis are also useful. These should be conducted not only above the water table but below the water table to evaluate them compared for your smear zone, LIF borings, membrane interface tool. Again, core photographs using that ultraviolet fluorescence nature and looking at LNAPL transmissivity maps. As well as there's geophysical data, as I talked about. And so now I'm going to hand it over to Jonathan Smith, and he's going to talk about remedy selection and what is the nature of the source.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. So, yeah, we're going to continue working our way through the remedy selection LCSM questions. Just thinking about what Andrew just talked to us about, answering that first question, we're primarily focused on identifying tools and concepts that help us determine where we need to target our remediation. Answering the next question on the nature of the source, we'll be focused a little bit more on maybe how we can remediate the source or maybe more specifically what remedial mechanisms are likely to be more effective. So we'll be looking at and talking about a lot of assessing the volatility of the LNAPL, determining whether or not it's biodegradable, and evaluating what fraction of the LNAPL is mobile versus residual. So we're referencing at the bottom of the slide here, Table 4.2 of the guidance document. It includes a pretty good list of tools and methods that we can use to assess different aspects of the source material. Those can be more qualitative pieces of information, like understanding what kind of LNAPL is at the site based on our knowledge of historical site use, or it might be more quantitative data, depending on our data needs, really. So next slide, we're going to be talking a lot about how we'd like to develop tools and metrics that we can incorporate into our remedy selection LCSM to evaluate the relative performance of different remedial mechanisms. So one of the really important metrics that we'll be talking about is LNAPL transmissivity for looking at recovery potential. So Mary's opened up the poll here. We wanted to gauge the level of experience that the class has with LNAPL transmissivity. So this is something that was introduced in part one of the training. Andrew gave us a really good case study example of how we can use LNAPL transmissivity to screen different recovery technologies with the vacuum truck and the skimming example earlier. And we're going to talk more about it throughout the training today. So we'll also be discussing other metrics that we can use for evaluating other mechanisms, how to look at LNAPL composition and what it tells us about biodegradability, volatility. But going back to our poll, It looks like there's a pretty good mix of experience and familiarity with on-apple transmissivity. So this is pretty typical to what we've seen in other classes. And really the material that we've put into the presentation today is intended to address a variety of experience levels. So we can probably close the pullout, Mary, and go to the next slide here. Okay, so all right, so here we're emphasizing that when we're trying to select a remedy, we want to characterize our site in a way that we can use that data and relate it to different remedial mechanisms. So here we're showing a sort of a linkage between remedial technologies on the left, and those technologies are going to utilize different mechanisms. And we can use the characterization data that corresponds to those technologies on the right to evaluate whether or not that particular mechanism that a technology uses is likely to be effective. So, for example, at the top here in blue, we're showing how we might rely on LNAPL transmissivity, or data that tells us what the fraction of LNAPL is that's mobile versus residual. This is going to help us decide whether or not a hydraulic recovery technology is likely to be effective. Or we might be looking at LNAPL composition and vapor pressure data to evaluate the effectiveness of technologies that rely on vapor phase mass transfer mechanisms like aquifer sparging and soil vapor extraction. And if we want to look at other technologies that rely more on enhancing biodegradation rates like bioventing or biosparging, we've got these characterization data in green. Maybe we want to consider completing an in-situ respiration test. So again, and Andrew emphasized this earlier, but it's worth noting again that the characterization data we've got when we're looking at the remedy select LCSM is often a little bit different than the data we use to develop the concerns LCSM. So, you know, in a lot of cases, if we were looking to identify concerns, we wouldn't need to characterize a lot of these aspects of the site unless we had already established that we needed to move to some sort of remediation. Okay, so we've got another poll question. If we can open up the poll, we're going to walk through an example exercise together. So here we've got a site with a dissolved phase concern. So maybe we've got benzene in groundwater sourced from an LNAPL body. So we can see in the figure to the right, we've got LNAPL transmissivity data indicating that the LNAPL is recoverable in this dark green area. We also have additional data indicating that the LNAPL is stable and not migrating. So we're going to wait for a moment and let people answer. But remember that our primary concern here is the dissolved phase plume. So we want to think back to part one of the training, if we were able to attend that, and maybe some of our discussion earlier in today's training on composition and saturation concerns, and think about whether hydraulic recovery is going to address a dissolved phase concern. Yeah, I think we've got a lot of answers on B, a little bit less on C. I think, you know, probably maybe the best answer is that we don't really have sufficient information. So we can close that poll. I could totally justify B, though, like I said, given what we learned in part one. And matching up the right kind of technology with a composition concern. So on this slide, we've got a little bit more complete picture of the LNAPL distribution at the site in three dimensions. So you can see the mobile LNAPL interval is only about 1 to 2 feet, but we've got residual LNAPL extending above and below by 30 to 60 feet. So while a hydraulic recovery approach would reduce the alnapple saturation within this this 1 to 2 foot mobile interval, the vast majority of the alnapple at the site is at residual saturation, so smeared out above and below that mobile interval. And any effort that we're going to focus on hydraulic recovery in that mobile interval is unlikely to have a dramatic effect on the groundwater quality concerns. So this is an example of a large refinery site. It's got some historical water table depression. But really the same kind of principles apply if we're looking at smaller sites. So we've got a scenario down below here. At the bottom of the slide, we're describing, similar conditions scaled back to represent a smaller release into a similar soil condition. So the relative difference that we've got in this scenario is, the difference between the mobile and the smear zone extent is maybe not quite as dramatic. But regardless, we need to have a more complete understanding of that vertical distribution of the mobile and residual if we want to identify a remedy that's going to address a given concern, and particularly the dissolve phase concern here. So here we're going to talk about what alnapple transmissivity tells us about mobile and residual alnapple fractions. So we've got some of the background information that was used to establish that 0.1 to 0.8 feet squared per day range. It was included in the 2009 ITRC guidance document. And to put that range in context, we can maybe start just with a thought experiment and note that alnapple at residual saturation has a zero transmissivity. So we've got alnapple that's distributed discontinuously in soil pores, and we can think of maybe a threshold value that would represent an alnapple saturation slightly above residual saturation, where a very small fraction of that alnapple can actually be recovered. So that's really what that 0.1 to 0.8 range represents. In most settings, if you've got an alnapple transmissivity in that range, it's a pretty strong line of evidence that the majority of the alnapple mass at your site is it's present as a discontinuous residual phase. So there's some additional references at the bottom of the slide on alnapple transmissivity, including a reference to the appendix C in the updated guidance. There'll be some additional discussion on this later today as well. So switching gears a little bit, I'm going to talk about how we characterize alnapple composition, how we think about volatility. So we've got some examples here of data that are often readily available that we can use to infer composition and volatility. So we might be able to use soil screening data, data with a photoionization detector, or maybe we have some knowledge of historical site use that we can use to better understand volatility. We can also rely on laboratory analyses. So for example, gas chromatography with a flame ionization detector, or GCFID. This can help us to identify what type of alnapple we have, and maybe help also to estimate the degree of degradation. So the bar chart at the bottom of this slide here is similar to what we get with a GCFID chromatogram. So to help us determine what the alnapple type is. And we're going to be sort of referencing back to this this sort of conceptual GCFID output on the next few slides. So, okay, on this slide, we're looking at the gasoline fraction of an alnapple chromatogram. So along the x-axis here, we've got smaller, lighter hydrocarbons on the left. And as we move to the right, the hydrocarbon compounds increase in molecular weight and boiling point. And then along the y-axis, the height of the peaks for these individual compounds gives us a good indication of their relative mole fraction in the elm apple. Here we've overlaid some of the individual constituent IDs, and this helps to give us a sense of how much detail we can really extract from a chromatogram like this. Really for today, we're primarily interested again in this range that's presented along the bottom of the chart. If we're looking at a chromatogram that's really concentrated in the gasoline range, that's going to help us to identify maybe that a volatilization sort of a remedy it might be an effective approach. Of course, we also have to remember what we learned in our discussion of where the source mass is located. So. We can't necessarily apply that volatilization mechanism unless we have appropriate geologic conditions for that type of remedy. So, all right. So, on this slide, we're looking at another chromatogram. This is an example of a fresh diesel chromatogram. So, we can see there's very little response in the blue gasoline range here. And that's why we really don't see much in the way of vapor phase concerns or dissolved BTEX concerns associated with diesel releases. So what we do see is these really tall peaks. And you can see these are all labeled as NC with a number. These are all normal alkanes. The normal alkanes are pretty ideal when you're thinking about a biodegradation remedy. So we'll talk a little bit more about that on the next few slides. But for now, I'll use this mention of biodegradation as a segue into a brief discussion on the importance of NSCD for our LCSM. So there's been a lot of development on NSCD over the past decade or so. And NSCD data, we're more frequently utilizing them in different ways to achieve different objectives. So as Andrew pointed out earlier today, we're more commonly looking at NSCD when we're looking at elm apple plume stability. So NSCD represents the control on elm apple migration, helps us to explain why elm apple bodies stabilize the way they so often do. We also learned a lot about NSCD in part one of the training series. There's going to be a lot more discussion of NSCD in part three next week. Today, we're really focused on evaluating biodegradation as a remedial mechanism, and NSCD can provide a useful baseline or benchmark for assessing biodegradation potential, evaluating the relative benefit of other remedial technologies and helping us to assess whether or not we can enhance that biodegradation. So similar to how we might think about elm apple transmissivity to assessing recovery potential or volatility to assessing a vapor phase removal potential. So we pointed out on two slides ago with the diesel chromatogram that the alkanes were really biodegradable. This is something that was touched on in part one of the training, where we saw that biodegradation is not really limited to the lighter, more soluble compounds in the elm apple. And really, that dissolution is not a necessary precursor for biodegradation to occur. So this is really important conceptually, because historically there was a really strong perception that conditions within elm apple source zones weren't conducive to microbial activity. So a lot of people thought that only the more soluble hydrocarbons would be susceptible to biodegradation. So we don't have a solubility limitation. We're also pointing out on this slide, however, that we do have some dependence on molecular structure. So saturated hydrocarbons tend to be more biodegradable, like the alkanes we're talking about, and then more highly branched hydrocarbons tend to be more difficult for microbes to utilize. So when we've got more complicated hydrocarbon branching structures with bonds that are more difficult to break, lower ratios of hydrogen to carbon, a lower energy yield. The microbes typically aren't as efficient at degrading those compounds. Okay, so on this slide, we're going to compare relative efficacy of different remedial mechanisms as a function of L-MAPL composition. So here we've got compounds with increasing molecular weight to the right along the x-axis of this chart. There we go. So this is similar to the sort of a simplified chromatogram that we've been looking at in the last few slides. We've got relative vapor pressure here, normalized to naphthalene in the purple bars, and not surprisingly, we can see that the lighter compounds within the gasoline range, these are the more volatile and likely more suitable for a vapor phase mass transfer mechanism. Now we're adding relative biodegradation rate constants, also normalized to naphthalene, shown in green here. And you can see that the biodegradation constants, they exhibit much less variability throughout the spectrum. So we've got a lot of NDs. These are points where we didn't have a data point to add to this chart. But generally, where we do have data points, there's not a whole lot of variability. So whereas the vapor phase ranges over like five orders of magnitude, the biodegradability is much less variable. So finally, we've got solubility added to the chart in the blue bars. And maybe a couple notes again. All of the values for each of these different mechanisms are normalized to naphthalene, which represents the heavier end of a gasoline range. So if you've got some experience working on gasoline sites, hopefully this provides a useful benchmark for comparison for you. The parameters that we're looking at are all in different units. So the absolute values that we're looking at aren't directly comparable, but what we can compare is the variability in those values by hydrocarbon constituent. So again, we've got a lot of variability in the vapor pressure, decreases by five orders of magnitude within the gasoline range compounds, and much more than that if we're moving further to the right in the chromatogram here. It's also worth noting that we've got, you know, while we've got the relative solubility shown on here, the biodegradability isn't really correlated to that solubility. And so, like we talked about on the last slide, that dissolution isn't necessarily a required precursor for biodegradation. Generally, the dissolution is poor relative to naphthalene across the whole spectrum. So here we're kind of summarizing different types of data that we can use to evaluate these different remedial mechanisms. So our ultimate goal is we want to be able to compare different technologies, relative performance of different technologies. So we know we're going to need to understand, no matter what kind of remedial mechanism we're thinking about, we need to understand L-MAPL distribution and permeability. We've talked about how we can use L-MAPL transmissivity to evaluate recovery potential. We can look at natural source zone depletion and respiration test data to help us think about whether a bioremediation approach might be effective, and composition data, which can help to inform bioremediation or vapor mass transfer remedies. And we've got some additional examples. So more characterization data that can be used to evaluate different technologies that rely on either a reagent delivery or maybe a carbon-based injection technology or surfactants and thermal remediation technologies. So sort of summarizing our discussion on the nature of the source here, We've got tools that we can use to evaluate the efficacy of these different remedial mechanisms we're talking about today. We don't need to just assume that we should implement some sort of hydraulic recovery. We can compare the expected performance between different mechanisms to determine which one or which combination of mechanisms might be the most effective to help us reach our goals. And now we're going to move into that that last big question on the remedy selection LCSM. What can we achieve with a given technology? So like Andrew mentioned earlier, this question really builds on the previous two questions. To determine what we can achieve with the technology, we'll need to understand subsurface conditions and LNAPL distribution, what the LNAPL characteristics are. We also need to think about the above ground considerations. So what is the current land use? What's the future land use look like? Safety and characteristics of the technology itself. So there's a lot of good information on different remedial mechanisms and the corresponding technologies that employ them in Appendix A and in Tables 4.3 and 4.4 of the guidance document. I'm going to learn more about these. I'll point you in that direction. So to start our discussion here on what is achievable with a given technology, we're going to take a closer look at LNAPL transmissivity again. So this is a metric, again, that we can use to evaluate what is achievable for hydraulic recovery. So our discussion on the next few slides, again, is going to provide some of the background on that 0.1 to 0.8 for square feet per day threshold for recoverability, and what that means with respect to recovery performance and what it means in terms of understanding what fraction of the LNAPL at our site is in a mobile versus a residual state. So we're going to be looking at data from four different sites, different subsurface conditions at each site, and you can see there's a decent contrast in permeability here. The hydraulic conductivity varies over about four orders of magnitude between these different sites. So we're looking at the fraction of the total LNAPL mass that was recovered as a function of LNAPL transmissivity here. So again, looking at the relationship between transmissivity and fraction of recoverable LNAPL, we've got four different sites. So site 1, 2, 3, and 4. And to begin, we're going to look at these numbers sort of along the x-axis here. And these indicate the initial LNAPL transmissivity, so prior to any remediation at the site. And we'll note that at all four of the sites, LNAPL transmissivity was tracked over time based on the recovery system performance. So we're using data from multiple recovery wells. And the fraction of the mobile and residual LNAPL was looked at using a combination of decline curve analysis, lab petrophysics, and soil TPH data. So you can see that the initial transmissivity values a lot higher at sites 1 and 2. It's important to note that for sites 1 and 2, the evaluation was focused almost exclusively on the mobile LNAPL interval. So essentially that interval where the LNAPL is accumulating in wells. So in this dashed line and sort of this conceptual cross-section that we've got on this slide. Whereas for sites 3 and 4, there was less recoverable LNAPL before remediation began, and there was soil PPH data available to help characterize the entire smear zone. So the area of this red or pink shading that's outside of that dashed line. So again, sites 1 and 2 within the dashed line only. Sites 3 and 4 included what's within the dashed line and the data that falls outside of the mobile zone. So next we're going to go over some of the information that's summarized on this bar chart. So we're going to just focus our attention on well 7 at site 1. So again, you can see at the bottom of the chart, we had an initial LMAPL transmissivity at this location of 14 square feet per day. Next, we've got this darker blue portion of the bar chart, and that was represents the fraction of the LMAPL that was recovered while the transmissivity was within or above that 0.3 to 0.8 square feet per day range. And we've noted here also the duration of time that the LMAPL transmissivity was above that range. So LMAPL recovery at well 7 for 2 years, and the transmissivity went from 14 square feet per day down into or below that 0.3 to 0.8 range. So you can see it's roughly 75% of the LMAPL over a period of 2 years. Next, we've got the light blue portion of the bar chart, and this is representing the fraction of the LMAPL that was recovered when the system was operated beyond that transmissivity threshold range. So again, you can see the amount of time that the system was operated at this condition. In this case, it's a little over a half a year. And we see the relative fraction of LMAPL that was recovered during that that time period, which is very little compared to what was recovered when the LMAPL transmissivity was within or above the range. So next we've got this this gray, which is maybe a little bit hard to see on this particular bar chart. And that's the remaining, an estimate of the remaining mobile LMAPL. So LMAPL that would continue to accumulate in wells, but was left in place. No further recovery was attempted. And then finally, we've got this granitic-looking pattern at the top of the bar chart, and that's representing the residual LMAPL. So this is the LMAPL that we can't recover hydraulically, regardless of how long or how hard we were to pump. Okay, so now we've sort of removed the blinders on the rest of the case study wells. So we've got wells from all four sites included. And we can note a few things about the recovery performance here. For example, sites 1 and 2, we can see that the recovery was a lot more efficient in the initial years of operation. And this is when the transmissivity was within or above that threshold range. You know, you can maybe note some differences in efficiency between site 1 and site 2. A lot of that comes back to the way the sort of the geometry of the recovery wells as they were installed. So site 1, recovery wells were installed on a grid pattern throughout the source area, whereas at site 2, the recovery wells were essentially installed along a transit through the LMAPL body, and as a result, we see a little bit weaker decline signal as the LMAPL was recovered over larger distances with less drawdown. So, again, site 3 and 4, very low transmissivity to begin with, and dominated by residual even prior to any recovery. So, again, having an LMAPL transmissivity less than about 0.8 square feet per day, generally a really strong indicator that the majority of the LMAPL mass at a site is in a residual state, and hydraulic recovery is probably not a very effective approach. So now we just spent a lot of time discussing that hydraulic recovery mechanism and LMAPL transmissivity. I'm gonna I think that's primarily because a lot of LMAPL remediation historically, this is, recovery is what people think of. Hydraulic recovery has been implemented with a focus on reducing saturation. It's just sort of how things were. But here we're comparing a mass removal potential based on data from the API LMAPL transmissivity database. So this is this chart on the left, and respiration test data. So this is a combination of data that was published by EPA from a series of, I think, 104 different bioventing studies in the 1990s, and some more recent pilot testing data. And you can see the removal rates. So along the x-axis here, the way these bar charts are plotted, that's the same numbers. And the frequency looks the frequency distribution looks pretty similar between the two different technologies here. So what we need to note is that the average removal rates for the bioventing sites are actually reported on a per foot of vadozone basis. So if we've got a smear zone that extends a few feet above the water table, we would predict that the bioventing rates would be proportionally higher than those shown in the chart. So additionally, worth noting that while the hydraulic recovery data, you know, this is sort of showing an initial condition maybe. But for hydraulic recovery, we often see an exponential decline in the recovery rate over time. So as we reduce the amount of mobile MAPL, that recovery rate drops off exponentially. But the microbial degradation processes that we're relying on for something like bioventing, they don't really have that limitation so much. So we tend to see higher rates of biodegradation sustained over longer periods of time, and that can act on the mobile and the residual on-apple fractions. So something to keep in mind if you're evaluating different mass removal technologies for a site. It's a good idea to not rule out, doing a respiration test to see how that compares with your bale down test data in terms of predicting recovery efficiency or mass removal efficiency. So we're going to talk a little bit about the volatilization mechanism. So on the right of the slide, we've got a series of chromatograms. These are showing changes in LMAPL composition over time as a gasoline LMAPL is sequentially volatilized. So again, each of these chromatograms is normalized to a naphthalene peak height. So this peak height should be about the same in each one of the chromatograms, and all the other compounds are changing relative to that. And we can see that as more of the gasoline is evaporated, the relative concentration of most of the compounds to the left of naphthalene anyway are steadily decreasing. And that tells us that technologies like SVE or multiphase extraction are probably going to be pretty effective in reducing benzene and overall GRO concentrations. So what's kind of interesting about this chart is that we can see that the relative to the other compounds in the gasoline mixture, the toluene, so it's highlighted here at the green text on each of the frames, it's not volatilizing as readily as the others. So this might lead you to question why we don't see toluene remaining at a lot of our SVE sites. And one likely answer is that the toluene is very biodegradable. And in addition to promoting the vapor phase mass transfer, remedial technologies like vapor extraction, multiphase extraction, they're also sort of acting as a bioventing system. So we're delivering oxygen to the subsurface to enhance biodegradation. And we'll talk about more about this later. We've got a case study to talk about it with, but it brings up again the significance of biodegradation for technologies like SVE, and it reminds us that when we're setting our performance metrics for an SVE system, it's often a good idea to consider measuring oxygen, carbon dioxide on the vapor influent to the system. In addition to, we conventionally look for VOCs if we're trying to quantify mass reduction. But incorporating those other fixed gases, the oxygen, the carbon dioxide, to help understand the biodegradation over time, we might see that a lot of times we've got a more significant biodegradation signal than we might have expected. So So another example, so a case study site where a multi-phase extraction system was implemented to address a gasoline release. So we've got this cross-section sort of showing general stratigraphy at this site. We've got sands and gravel channel deposits with an overlying finer-grained overbank deposits. Now we're looking at this chart. It's showing mass removal over time with three different mechanisms. So we are tracking of hydraulic recovery. That's the line in black, and vapor phase partitioning. So this is the gray line here, and biodegradation shown in this sort of greenish line here. So we can see LNAPL recovery was it had a brief high here. So the dominant mechanism within maybe the first year of operation, and then vapor phase removal performed pretty well for a lot of this full 6 year time frame we're looking at. Ultimately, though, the dominant removal mechanism was the biodegradation, and this is for a gasoline site again. So 6 years of operation, we still have benzene in groundwater at this site that needs to be addressed. So maybe Juliana, if you could open the poll question for this slide, or I'm sorry, Mary. we're sort of looking for everyone's thoughts. So, given the results that we're just looking at here, what kind of remedial mechanisms might make the most sense for this site? A lot of people so far are answering with bioremediation. And I think definitely would get on board with that. Something like biosparging maybe to focus on the remaining mass below the water table at the site probably makes a lot of sense. Mary, we can close that poll question and move on to the next slide. So here we're emphasizing the need to combine what we know about the technical limitations of different technologies with our site limitations. So for example, we probably wouldn't be considering a thermal remedy beneath an active refinery. And we probably need to consider the negative effects of whatever waste streams we might be generating from our remediation systems. A technology that requires groundwater recovery or water table depression, maybe that's going to be more appealing at a site where we've got an operating industrial facility with extra capacity to treat groundwater. It's probably going to be a lot more palatable than trying a similar remedy at a small gas station site where that infrastructure just isn't present. Or maybe we need to, we're operating an SV system and we would need to burn a lot of propane to operate an oxidizer on the off-gas side of the system. We need to consider whether or not aerobic biodegradation might be a more appropriate way. It's possible that that's the dominant mass removal mechanism as it is. So we might consider modifying or optimizing that system to focus more on that particular mechanism. When we're thinking about what is technically achievable, we can apply a sort of a tiered approach. And this is like what we talked about earlier today for the initial concerns LCSM. If we're looking at a more complex site or a site with a greater concerns, greater risks, we probably want to be more quantitative in our evaluation. And we can use our LCSM to compare mass removal rates or the relative efficacy of different technologies for meeting whatever our specific goals are for the site. So direct you to table 4.4 in the guidance document provides some good references to some calculation tools, models that you can use to evaluate different mechanisms. We touched on this earlier, I think, but it's worth sort of revisiting here. You know, when we were trying to select the best remedy or the best combination of remedies, technologies, we need to be able to compare relative performance for those different technologies. And that can be challenging sometimes because each of the different technologies we're considering, they're likely to utilize different mechanisms. So a lot of times we have to, make an effort to make sure we're actually comparing those different technologies on a level playing field. So I've got some examples here of different metrics that are used. For example, here we're saying if your remedy is focused on mass reduction, maybe it makes the most sense to compare the pace of remediation in the sort of growing conventional NSCD units of gallons per acre per year or something similar. And the same goes for other objectives as well. If we've got a specific compound that we're targeting, we probably want to look at, what is the concentration reduction over maybe normalizing to the volume of formation that we're treating, something of that nature. But the important part is we want to compare between different technologies. That's how we're going to be able to make the best decision. So to summarize, the technically achievable portion of the remedy selection LCSM, we want to make sure everyone's aware we've got tools available that can help us evaluate different remedial mechanisms, the efficacy of different mechanisms. We don't want to just assume that a hydraulic recovery remedy is the answer. If we have recoverable elm apple at a site, we can compare expected performance for other technology groups and determine which one is likely to be the most effective. So got some examples of that here. We're going to end the remedy selection LCSM with a knowledge check here. So this is a case study where we've got sheen on a creek, elm apple in a well nearby. So elm apple transmissivity is pretty low, 0.05 feet squared per day. So we want to know what do you think? Should we be implementing a recovery remedy? Should we be considering one? Is recovery likely to be the final remedy for a site like this? And some of your thoughts on what else we can do to maybe help improve our remedy selection process. So, yep, here we're showing we've got a lot of people saying yes, recovery should be considered. I think about a quarter of the people that have responded so far, maybe a little bit more as we go, a third maybe, saying probably not. I think there's not really necessarily a wrong answer. I think the fact that we have a really low elm apple transmissivity sort of points towards the recovery mechanism as not being a very efficient way to go. But that being said, a lot of times when we've got a concern like this, a potential for sheen on a creek, we might consider a hydraulic based remedy as an interim measure. It's easy to implement and we can do it quickly. So is hydraulic recovery going to be the final remedy? It's 100% no, and I would 100% agree. So I think we've got a lot of people, nobody's answered A, that we're good to install a final remedy, which I think is the most important part of the last question here. And with that, I'll turn the presentation back over to Eric Nichols, Substrata, to talk about the elm apple decision process.
Thanks, John. So we're in the home stretch here. And let's advance the slide here. You've seen this slide before. It's just a reminder that now that we've covered the remedy selection aspects of the LCSM, we're going to turn back to the decision process just to reiterate a couple of key points. you've seen the slide. It's a reminder that a remedy needs both performance metrics to assure that it's being implemented effectively, and one or more endpoints that define when you're done, when the remedy has done its job, and all of these together are SMART. So a little bit more on performance metrics. They are and can very well be technology specific. So once you have an idea of the technology you have in mind, start thinking about performance metrics that allow you to verify that the remedy is in fact being implemented effectively. It also gives you an opportunity to make mid-course corrections, optimizations, things that make that remedy perform better over time. And it allows you to track steady progress towards an endpoint, an eventual endpoint. Now, what do we mean by all this? An example of this would be, let's say we've developed a aerobic biodegradation remedy, say for some bioventing. And bioventing is really acting to stimulate aerobic biodegradation, so we need to make sure that we have sufficient oxygen in the targeted soils that we're trying to do a compositional change in. So monitoring those targeted soils for a threshold minimum oxygen content would be a good way of making sure that bioventing is doing its job in the places where we need it to do its job. And then final couple of points about endpoints. They are also technology specific. And in addition to telling you when you're done and can close out a remedy, they also may be the point at which you've reached the practicable limit of the technology. And what we mean by that is you may know already that a particular technology, although it's going to do a good job at getting you close to the goal post, based on experience and the mechanisms that the technology uses, you may know that it's not going to get you all the way there. So it may be a transition point that is defined by an endpoint. These types of transitions should be expected and planned. If you're disappointed or surprised by the performance of the technology, you've probably done it kind of wrong. That we should think about these things in advance and have an idea of what the technology is capable of. And if it's not going to get us all the way to the goalpost, think about the next phase in the treatment train, which often for many sites is going to be natural source zone depletion, as the sort of final step in that treatment train. So let's do a quick poll. Very simple, three options here. For the statement, remedial endpoints, remedial performance metrics and endpoints, which is true? Are they optional? Are they the same for every technology? Or are they technology specific and site specific? And you guys are paying very good attention. Thank you for that. Everyone, early polling suggests a clear winner for choice C, technology-specific and site-specific. So in the interest of time, let's just go ahead and close that out. And I'll move us on to our next slide. So putting all together the process steps that we talked about before, this first column shows a worked-out example of a particular LNAPL concern being verified using a particular threshold metric, leading to verifying that concern and establishing specific remedial goals, and then determining a very specific set of remediation objectives, leading to a particular remedy, and some establishing some specific performance metrics for that remedy and some specific remediation endpoints. Now, these are not necessarily the only outcomes for this concern. There may be other standards and other remedies, but this is just one example of kind of a completed problem set for this particular concern, leading to a resolution with a specific endpoint. And a couple other examples here. So that first column was for a risk-based concern. This next column would be for a LNEPL mobility-based concern, and it shows some specific examples of how you get there, how you navigate your roadmap to get from point A to point B. And then the third example here with an LNEPL occurrence concern, the MET requirement, leading to a particular saturation-based remedy, leading to a some transmissivity metrics to tell us when we're done. And these and more examples are worked out in the guidance document. So where are we in our kind of overall roadmap? We've talked about the LNEPL assessment LCSM. We've talked about this decision framework to set up our remedial technology selection. John has talked about some of the considerations we need to make to select a technology. And what you're going to see in next week's class is really this red box of how to, in more detail, select remedial technologies, how to compare them against one another, and how to implement them. So this is another preview, again, of next week. You'll see a multi-step process to select or screen technologies and select them. And there'll be steps involving screening against various technologies against your remedial goals and against geologic and factors and LNEPL characteristics. There'll be a comparative analysis. It may require gathering more data in terms of critical data needs, and then ultimately selecting a technology that best addresses your concerns. So we've laid a foundation through module 1 and 2 that allow you to get the most out of next week's module 3. And to summarize what we've covered so far today, this LCSM evolution that we described is a systematic decision-making process. If we develop that LCSM through its various stages of evolution, it's going to allow us to identify LNAPL concerns and then select a remedy and then implement that remedy. We need this to establish remedial goals on those verified concerns. This will help us identify the right technologies to abate those concerns. And that LCSM is referred to and refined and evolved as needed through the next phases of design and remedy implementation. And all of these together lead to a smart process with smart outcomes. And with that, I'm going to turn this back over to Tom Fox to give us some wrap-up comments.
Thank you, Eric. Well, we're near the end of our Part 2 training on using the new ITRC LNAPL document. And next week in Part 3, we're going to be discussing remedial technology groups, as Eric has mentioned, introducing some specific remedial technologies, providing a framework for technology selection, also introducing some tools to screen the technologies, which one do you use and when. Also be introducing performance metrics so you can optimize your efforts and decide when it's time to stop or even use another technology. And we're also going to be looking at a case study to demonstrate the use of these tools. So during the next week, I'd like you to think about one of your sites and what data you have available to go through a short remedy selection LCSM exercise so you can select potential remedial technology mechanisms and confirm the current remedial technology if it's even appropriate. And we're going to be giving you some additional insight on these technologies next week, and we hope that'll help you with your evaluation. So with that, I will say good day.
All right, thanks, Tom. We do want to wrap today's session up. I'm going to pull up a few more poll questions I'd like to have you fill out as we're wrapping up today. If you do want to get access to that guidance document and haven't looked at that already, you can access it through our links page. All these links pages will remain active following the training and certainly into next week's Part 3 and even beyond that. If you have missed one of the parts or want to go back and listen to it again, we have archives of previous offerings of the same class back in October and November of 2018. Those archives are already available. You're welcome to check those out, and you can access those through the ITRC website in the Internet-based training section. If you're someone who needs a feed to have a certificate of participation for your involvement today, if you'll please fill out that feedback form, and at the bottom there's a box you can click on to certify you participated, that will generate a certificate of participation for you. We do have time for one quick question here, and then we do need to wrap up today. And it says, how can I measure saturation on elm apple, and can I estimate the volume of the plume?
Hi, this is Andrew. So you can measure saturation if you take a soil sample and send it to the lab for TPH. You can convert that TPH into a saturation. That TPH is milligrams of oil per kilogram of soil. And you simply need to convert that into volume of oil per volume of pore space using soil density and oil density and porosity. Alternatively, you can take soil cores and you can freeze them on dry ice and set them to a petrophysical lab, and they can do saturation analyses on it called Dean Stark. But the saturation varies dramatically within 6 inches vertically in a site and aerially. So measuring the complete volume across the site is often fairly difficult. It's better perhaps to do a high resolution characterization on a single soil boring, understand what that distribution is, and then use other lines of evidence to extrapolate that conceptually to other locations where you say you have soil boring logs, and look at other metrics than volume to what you're trying to change at the site. You know, that's one of the challenges that has driven people to the realization it's difficult to get all of the volume out or even understand how much volume is there and compare that to what you're getting out. That's why looking at composition-based goals and phase change technologies and making sure you're reducing benzene and reducing that risk metric, or looking at plume stability and ensuring that those plumes are stable, is because the challenge is with just getting all the volume out and focusing on volume have not proven to drive effective projects over time.
All right, thank you, Andrew. We do need to wrap up today. If we have not addressed your question and you would like to follow up with us after the class, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with the trainers. A very special thank you to our volunteer trainers. We really appreciate all your time and expertise on not only this class, but all of the series of classes we have on LNAPL. Again, we would like to get everyone's feedback today, and if you do need that certificate of participation, make sure you click the box at the bottom of that feedback form and press submit, and that will generate the certificate of participation for you. ITRC has a variety of classroom and online training classes, many guidance documents available, so please do check out our website at itrcweb.org, and that will wrap us up for today.